difference to give the councillors elected. So that's a bit of history for the transfer. And if you have a look at the detail that's in those election procedures, but those are the provincial councils, yes, or societies. So that's the history, that's where this is coming from. Then going to clause 8, membership of the council. I don't think there was anything there, Chair. To explain this, when we get to clause 12, when we dealt with clause 12 last time, refresh your memory, the question that deals with the vacation of office and questions arose who decides that a person is incompetent or is not engaging in activity that undermines the integrity of the council and who initiates the vacation of office. So as doctors, we made a proposal for clause 12 and that has a bit bearing on the provision that we are in now. Isn't it really what we are dealing with here is removal from office, if I can take it to clause 12, because that will then explain clause 9. That did reads the council must, a member of the council must vacate office on account of conviction, incapacity or incompetency, etc. So we've swung it around for the consideration of the committee. The council may remove a member of the council from office on account of conviction, any misconduct under this act, raise the question whether it shouldn't be an offence, incapacity or incompetency, which in the opinion of the council debars him or her from serving as a member of the council, absence from 3 meetings, a request by the body, which or person who, not nominated, but rather elected, or designated that member in terms of section 7 on good cause shown by the body in question, or as an alternative, there was that whole long debate when we last about the sensitivities and concerns that were raised, whether the person nominating, the body nominating, could act well or very easily get rid of his or her nominee just because of some silly frivolous little thing. And we were asked to consider the inclusion of the court intervention. So it would be on a request by the body which a person who elected or designated that member on good cause shown by the body or person in question upon confirmation thereof. But I think that that brings in the court intervention is the limited size to go that route. So with that as background, Chair, that's why the amendments have been made in clause 8 to the and you will see that if the committee approves that principle, the removal or the vacation in the other portions of the bill where those have come up have been amended accordingly.
Thank you, Chair. On the question of the appeals court reading, don't we end up with apologies? Without permission. I'm just thinking of the person who is involved in an accident. That person is not yet trying to be asking for permission.
That is in there, but absence for 3 consecutive meetings. Oh, that is.
Oh, it's 3 consecutive meetings without permission. Or a good cause, yes. Well, he's laying in hospital. That's good cause.
Yeah, we don't want to apologize because we know some members just permanently give apologies and then just never go and then
yes.
Come into contact. Yes. So there might be a good reason.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Can't say I have to take my baby to crash.
Well, that's a good
reason. What in here is to accept them before, sir?
Yes.
Yes. also, if you have a look at similar provisions elsewhere in the law dealing with the other bodies, that just for the sake of consistency, suggest that we have those words. The amendments in clause 5, we've already discussed, removal from office. The amendments in sub-clause 6 are really just to align the wording here with the wording in similar provisions elsewhere in the book, as soon as possible thereafter, or it was as soon as may be convenient. And the other provisions dealing with chairperson and deputy chairperson, the wording was as soon as possible thereafter, and that possibly sounds better than as soon as may be convenient. That's it.
Not here a difficulty which I don't think was discussed before. Again, of course, it will depend upon the composition. If, you know, for argument's sake, you retained the present composition, you know, 10 years versus 10 applicants and a sprinkling of others, then the arithmetic tells you that the chairman is going to be an attorney. And only if people want to make a nice gesture would they put an advocate in as a deputy. So if you will try to persuade you not to do, if we have two chances for that, that's good. But if you retain this kind of configuration, then surely you should consider the provisions which get represented in these two posts alternatively, that you have co-chairs. And as a further alternative, I would really like us to think about putting a judge in as chair, irrespective of whether we need two chambers or retain the kind of configuration. It draws the sting out of all the accusations of ministerial interference, and that it's clear that all members of the legal profession are officers of the court. The independence of their profession, just because they form part of the judicial branch of the state. And I think we could say a retainer judge, as has been proposed for the ombuds. I'm not even convinced there needs to be a retired judge, if we are very experienced in judicial counsel. I think it would be very easy to have this person in the chair. But I leave the thought that the arithmetic that you've got could be it's going to give you an attorney in the chair every time. And I don't think that's the time.
Would it be conceivable that a further clause be added that the chair and deputy chair position will alternate between the attorney and the advocate?
And that when the one is one, then the other one will be added. So the chair and deputy will.
Yeah.
The suggestion for a judgment on the transitional council might have merit, because that's where there's going to be a lot of negotiations, and it might be helpful to have an independent chairperson to try to resolve all those hard issues. So that's something that we might need to consider.
For that body that I first put up the idea in my head, but I thought deciding we shouldn't have the transitional at all. And it seemed to me that But there's this in mind. Look, I mean, the practice rules and the product rules that you now want to make part of this regulator's work, those are the things that have always been created by the professionals themselves. And it's the courts that have the inherent jurisdiction. I mean, we're sitting with some fundamental stuff here. The courts have the inherent jurisdiction to sit on the bar rules, for example. So it's very pleasing to bring the judiciary in on the council, and it can only be in the home of a chair.
Committee requested the department to find out how long members of law societies hold office and to look at other statutory bodies in this regard. The general trend that various law societies have different periods, it would seem, but it would seem as if the general rule is that the whole term, maximum of two terms of approximately 3 years. I've got some information on what the other professions do. For instance, in terms of auditing profession, the 2005 Act, members of the regulatory body hold office for a period of 2 years, which is renewable once. Engineering Profession Act, members of council hold office for a period of 4 years, which is renewable once. In terms of the Architectural Profession Act 2000, members of the council hold office for a period of 4 years, which is renewable once. In terms of the Health Professions Act, members of the council hold office for a period of 5 years, which is also renewable once. So that's the trends you're asking.
Yeah. makes bad on the council and its other members.
And because we find your idea, and we, you know, it's fun, that you are, I mean, then you say it, and it's going to be a court of remedy.
This is pretty standard, the way that across the statute book, this is the way it reads, but I understand the problem.
Council may remove on conviction.
There is uncertainty there. That's why we put the offence in. What is it? That's where we need to be more certain in clause 12. Is it misconduct in terms of the disciplinary procedures, or is it an offence? And maybe it should be, I think it should be only internal. And I'm wondering whether we should talk about conviction. Yes. Yes, I think there should be other wording, because if it's going to be misconduct, in terms of this act, then maybe the word conviction isn't correct. Misconduct will be dealt with in the code of conduct, which is going to be drafted, and that will specify all the, I'm sure, unprofessional and unworthy conduct as is going to be the suggestion.
I think the current discrepancy between 8 and 12 comes because we changed the beginning of 12.1. It was a member must vacate. So in other words, what is insolvent or unsound or convicted, he removed himself. But now we put in the council must do it, and that's why there's kind of a discrepancy now. So the council decide or not. Because several other statutes has this in that a member must take up. Probably at this level.
At which level?
Well, the court is almost before anyone.
Oh no.
No, I was just explaining how this script it was.
No, that's very, very valuable. And I thought you were going to go back
to your lawyer. That's the case. They don't want their cases in public. You only hear about it when the court say, bye bye, we just keep disbarging. That's the old time. Up until then, oh yes.
What happens then that they keep remembering?
Yes.
rather than whether
I mean, in 1811, it's more objective. I mean, you keep your member if you're unrehabilitated, but you'll have a court order to hear you and so on. You'll be declared by a court to your unsigned mind, you'll be convicted of an offence. That's all objectively attainable. This stuff is basically more substitute interpretation, i.e. you have to have internal processes inside the council. And then they might say, well, it's not so critical that we feel that you should be removed. Maybe you missed three meetings, but you did have some kind of excuse, and you know, and you promised not to do it again, so they don't think it's justified you being removed as a member. You know, it's lesser. It could be lesser offence,
I think. Possibly could we remove the delete 12(1)(a), because that's the only thing. If you're convicted, you're convicted. The other bit, some kind of discretion that can be exercised by the council. That would be meant in accordance with clause 8(2)(c).
I thought in 12(1)(a) we agreed we'd remove the conviction for an offence. But the conviction for misconduct, that's something else, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just if you made it second, but look at maybe saying something like a finding of guilty for misconduct by the council. And then leave the discretion up to them. But let's just see later on when we finish the bill what kind of potential conditions there could be, and whether it's worth keeping it on. Otherwise, we could maybe take the suggestion and take it on.
The finding of the conduct by the council. You're saying misconduct, you mean the code of conduct that they're going to write. The code of conduct they're going to write is called legal practitioner. Not the council. So who's going to make those comments? It's not going to be this council, which is the regulator itself, who, by the way, is here in the municipality. It's going to be your legal council, right? And so it's going to be a finding of misconduct.
Sure.
But realistically, it's not going to be.
And then zero?
Yeah.
So that's a big debate that we're coming to. Remember, in our last, and we're going to talk, some research has been done on the ombudsman we've asked to do, and I think things, if there is a chapter where we're not as drafters, not too sure which way to go, that is the chapter. And I think we're going to talk about the research that's been done. We have done some work on it, but we were sent away to take away the review powers, or to draft an option of the review powers of the ombud. And so that's pretty fluid, Chip.
Yeah, I thought that they would have disabilities.
I don't have the competitive study to prove this, but I think whenever we designate somebody and send the person to serve somewhere, the provision to have more or removed by hyper-replication is unusual.
Can we move on?
Yes.
Yes?
No,
I don't know, I was about to take a statement of his state here when it automatically had gone for removal of revocation under 811. I don't see why we have it here at all. I think it should take now.
Thank you.
That was also discussed. Before we provided this when we discussed this with the law advisors, they did raise a reservation whether such an approach is proper.
Which one?
In, this is clause 14, where the alternative where you use a court to do the work of the minister and the separation of powers comes into play. Maybe the law advisors would like to come in from that. If you did prepare an option that the committee asked us to.
Thank you, Julie. The current bill, as it was introduced, the process for distribution is that the minister may, after having asked the council for reasons, and then the minister appoints a judge, not in active service, to conduct an investigation and make a recommendation to the minister. That was in the bill. The option we have relates to supplement 1 to 3, that was just discussed. First, the minister loses confidence and then he calls the council for reason and an explanation. If the minister is not satisfied, he then requests the ombuds to conduct an investigation and make recommendations. And thereafter, if the minister still doesn't have confidence in the ability of the council, then the minister might approach the High Court. So it's highly often part of the ombud court that is the option. Then another option that could be considered is to stop at the ombud, not to go to the court, or to skip the ombud and go to the court directly.
Strongly about my opposition to the dissolution of the council, and I think it was intimated that this clause came in at a very late stage in the whole process, and I think this also goes to the heart of the concerns without any reflection on the present minister or anything, but just when we're looking forth on the possible abuse of executive power when it comes to the dissolution of the council. And I'd just like to remind us what former Chief Justice Chesterton said in this regard. I deal firstly with the present formulation, that, and it seems as well in the second formulation, that the minister is not bound by any judicial inquiry or by the ombuds inquiry. He can still go ahead. The second formulation is a slight improvement. And then the first formulation, first of all, it's a sort of demoppy that hangs over the council. And second, as Judge Chatkerson said, it's inconsistent with the independence of the profession, which goes to the heart of the independence of the judiciary. And just to quote him, he says, is calculated to secure compliance rather than resistance from the council should it have differences on important issues based on that service between them. So I think it's important for us to bear that in mind. This comes from, and he adds that the statute being proposes we take a number of the executive issues together, and he said, the structure is being proposed which opens the door to important aspects of the profession being controlled by the executive, and that is inconsistent with an independent legal profession. So it would do us well to bear these in mind when we consider this. Now, we're not dealing here with a parastatal where the minister can dissolve. This is dealing with the legal profession and an independent judiciary, and I think we need to be very careful again considering should there be a minister in the future disagrees with the decision or the composition of the council. There's no obligation at the present formulation of the alternative to even adhere to the judge's investigation. But that doesn't have to be. He still comes and says, well, I disagree with the judge, now I go my own route. Now the second formulation has its own problems, which the legal advisors have pointed out. So we need to think very carefully as to whether we need this clause at all. And I think we need it if that is, and I think I'll leave it at that.
Let me ask you this question. Can I give him your clause and then to you equal times a year? No. If he fails to do so,
should happen. Just that simple. Just like nothing else. We're not talking about decisions the minister disagrees with.
Sure.
The proposition.
Well, you've got various avenues. Firstly, you've got the designated bodies that attend people to the council. They can take steps. The attorney's profession, the advocate's profession, and say, well, why aren't you meeting and take action against the council as well? They can, because they have the mandate to act in the best interest of their own designated. Remember, it's a designated body. They are sent to represent a body. And so if that is, again, it's getting back to the profession themselves, and the minister of appointments that are there as well. And so, look, you know, it's take action now of our own body. There's nothing to prevent them going as well to court to get the character, the council themselves. Why do we have to have the minister? They and it's you know, the law society can get the characters at the moment as well. So that is a possible answer. I'm not saying it's a definitive answer, but it is a possible answer on the basis that they are not meeting. Again, if they are not meeting, they can they're not meeting for three consecutive meetings that have been set down, then the other things kick in about why without permission that was kicking out. That's a possibility. But that's a less strong argument, I would submit. But I think there is the bodies that send designated members. Definitely I would think they get action there. Thank you, Chair.
I just on that point, I mean, I don't think there's nothing also that's really preventing the minister from taking it to court also for not complying with their obligations to them from the legislation, and I would think that probably would be expected. I mean, if it says they have to meet no less than four times a year and they're not meeting, then you can also go to court. I think that's preferable. The other thing that's completely unacceptable to me is the fact that he can go and replace with seven members that he just decided to choose himself for 6 months. I mean, that is totally out. And the other concern I have is that on both options there isn't really anything, I mean, I'm not sure if it's implicit in the fact that they can't be appointed for longer than 6 months, but if we take that out, there's no obligation to form a new council, or how to be formed, or I mean, what is the intent really? We just leave it, then we're going to perform all these functions that the council thinks.
Yeah.
Sure.
I will only repeat that I will not even contemplate supporting this law if it retains a dissolution provision of any description. Independence and dissolution are in the Mekong. The dissolution is incompatible with the idea of independence. You create independent bodies so that they are independent. The contradiction in terms of independence and dissolution. And you know, I think we briefly before discussed whether there even are other results. I told you I've been in this movie before in the case of the SABC. I mean, it was for every ulterior motive that a provision was created whereby that body could be dissolved, and it was precisely replaced, just as this one is, as the shape of the point, and replaced by a hand-picked half dozen, a hand-picked ministerial half dozen. But clearly, I mean, in the case of the SABC, it was for clearly ulterior purposes. You can't trust one other example of yet what it was. What was it?
Medical.
Okay. Yeah, which for whatever the reasons are for which it exists, I'm simply not persuaded by it. And as for your question, Chairman, what have I failed to meet? It's sort of the ductio ad absurdum, and it just isn't going to happen. I mean, it isn't. But you know, just a last thought. I mean, don't make it easy for the guys to challenge you and take you down in court. If we do a law like this with a resolution provision, we're straight to court and it'll be struck down. The easiest thing in the world. It's inconsistent with independence. And Stephen's going to judge Chesselson. So there they have their authority remade. It's inconsistent with the independence of the profession and you will be thrown out in court. Don't do it.
I'm not interrupting that debate, but it's just another possible option. I know it might not hold in favour of hearing what has been said and said before, is for the ombud to play a more prominent role. The ombud is there to advise and be a watchdog. So the ombud could investigate on its own initiative or the request of anybody and approach the principle of the minister's involvement, so that the minister isn't involved. That's just a variation on the theme. That's from the feminist consideration. It's not the minister, it's the minister's upon them, and it's done by an independent body the application is made to them.
Yeah, I think about as far as I
there was an issue that was raised here by Mr. Warren here regarding the issue of separation of powers, the alternative that has been brought on for the department on the issue of the dissolution of the council. The new alternative is that the minister loses confidence in the council. The minister will approach the High Court for an order that empowered the minister to dissolve the council. Now this also means that the executive will approach the judiciary so that the judiciary can say, executive, you can do this. Right. It seems to be a people like to regard the issue of separation of powers.
Mm-hmm.
Now the current proposal check that the minister will dissolve the council. There seems to be guidelines before the minister can actually dissolve the council, because the minister will provide reasons to the council for losing confidence. And then the minister will give the council the opportunity to state its case as to why it should not be dissolved. And then the minister will have to consider any submission of sea. And even then, the minister will have to, there will have to be a charge appointed by the minister who will investigate the issues and make a recommendation to the minister. Now, Chair, there was an issue raised that the minister has just ignored those recommendations of the appointed charge. But in my view, Chair, I don't think the minister, I mean, it would be anybody who could take the minister to review, the minister would just ignore. The minister will have to apply his mind to the recommendations of the appointed charge. It's like, say, when you say the minister must have a consultation with the board or the council, make a decision, the minister will have to take into account and consider and apply his or her mind properly to the issues of health, and then make the regulations. But, say, that is our view at the most part. Anyway, we kind of recommend on what approach to take. Thank you, sir.
I said that it's potentially a problem of separation of powers, but it's equally a problem of separation of powers interfering in the independence of the profession. And I think it's far more dangerous if the ministers decide to dissolve the council than it is. I mean, legal practice, if it's statutory obligation, then the legal practice will be the last compliance. Like we learned to do in NPA.
In my real mind, I'm just saying, you know, if we so much respect the independence of the judiciary, why are we so much liking to control the executive? I'm worried about that.
No,
give me a chance and give rural women a chance. Let me express myself. I'm not a lawyer, but I hold that feeling. And I think I'm not far away from being right, you know? Because I love the thing of separation of power. But it seems we emphasize so much on the independence of one part of the judiciary. But when it comes to the executive, though, we want to tie them down, control the items.
We've already been through, it's modelled on Section 174 of the Constitution, the need for the staff of the council to reflect more on the racial and gender composition of the council must be considered when the executive office and other employees are appointed in terms of this
equity or one of the labour laws, I already do this. I'm actually not opposed because given the field we're working in, it's not a bad idea to make it here. But doesn't employment equity or one of the other laws require?
No, it's not employment equity.
CEO and stuff. We're talking about CEO and stuff.
It's employment equity act. Requires plans to be put in place to ensure that.
Oh, that's right, just not that one. Yeah. Which is one of the things you.
Half of the council.
No, it's another slogan.
Well, no,
this
is terrible
stuff.
Why are we even
thinking about this? It was in the bulletin introduced, and you asked us to make sure that you had consistency throughout the. As far as these provisions are concerned.
Yeah,
no, it's fine.
This is what's
there for bottom. Yes. And the same applies for
clause 20 and 3. There's our four people. You're going to want every province, every region, every.
Interesting wording that there are four members of the board, and then the members of the executive committee shall, as far as possible, be so appointed in order that the different English groups which are represented on the board shall also obtain representation on the executive committee. And then maybe an overall.
conclusion of
whether it's 5 or 7,
yes.
The quorum is still the majority of the members of the council.
Yes.
So if it's 5, they're supposed to 5, and 4 is present, they use a quorum, then it means a decision can be 2-2.
Oh, I see what you mean. Can you see the problem with the guy?
I'm not connected.
Well, what Ms. Adams is saying is if the EXCO requires a new tenant to come down, and instead of all 6 turning up, only 4 turn up, chair that deputy chair and crew up, that means they have a call, and they never see it. And the 4 members then must decide. And the decision holds to 2, what happens?
Is it also a requirement that the chairperson must at all times be present? What if you need
to
decide
whether that person will.
Okay, the chairperson for that specific meeting.
Sorry, it's local.
Chair, code 95.1.8 provides that the council can make rules on the procedure to conduct meetings. And, possibly quorum, I think, scope has to be addressed there. Matters can't be left to regulations to be decided at some future point by the
council. No, I could be.
Alright. Rule 16 is the quorum and procedure meetings of council. Yes.
16
and 17 is decisions of council, with 17 through 6 above statement, and the voting of the chairperson has a casting vote. That's what we were talking about. Yes, but the point I'm making is, if we decide that the EXCO should be 5 or 7 or any uneven number, EXCO is 5 and 4 is present that day, which means the quorum has been met, and if a decision has to be taken, it can easily split 2-2.
And then 17-2.
But chairman would be part of that quorum.
Well, where is chairman? Do you have a casting vote?
You just say that the chairperson of that meeting.
Of that meeting. Well, that's a seven. Yeah. Not the appointed or elected chairperson, but the chairperson at that meeting. The whole class is there a person.
Yeah.
Well, 1716 deal with council, we're dealing with executive council. Yes, I've got a feeling that they're likely to be a provision inserted. Yes, for that purpose.
All right. Which comes back to the question, should they be fit? Doesn't matter anymore. We leave it at 6. All right, think about it.
Clause 7, that was at the suggestion of the LSSA, suggesting that the chairperson of the council should be ex officio chairperson of the executive committee, and this committee seemed to agree to that.
Is the deputy chairperson of the council ex officio deputy chairperson of the
council? Well, it says here that I'm going to say that. Well, that affects B, 7B.
Yes, that also changes. But that's assuming movement of direction.
And that takes us to clause 21, delegation of powers. The original wording was council may delegate in writing, and we suggested that the wording should be looked at, and we suggested that it now read the council may resolve to delegate any of its powers. And it also suggested that the delegation should also apply to the executive officer or an employee of the council. That was a suggestion made by the LSSA, and I think it was agreed to by the committee. And we move on to finance, clause 22, and there was a single suggestion there. 2023, the establishment of regional councils, the long clause was said, and I say that we were asked to come up with some preliminary options that we've done, and that revolved around the establishment of regional councils. Our suggestion in subclause 2 is that council must establish at least 3 or 4, as it says there, and ask the diet to assist. Those numbers must need to change, and following factors must be taken into account. There may not be more than one regional council per province. The location of the seats in the High Court or the provisions of the High Court must be taken into account. And then from 3 to 7, those were already criteria that were included in subclause 5 below, which has just been moved and that is what the are about. I don't know whether you can go on.
This is one of those proposals and visions that are controversial, and in the sense that we anticipated that if we simply leave it to the wording as the division was, there must be additional controls set up. Could we anticipate that the current configuration, you've got the SNP, that which is the biggest of the provincial law societies, incorporating Limpopo, Gauteng, North Wales, and Mpumalanga, being split up actually into those regions, Cape Law Society having a regional council in Western Cape, Eastern Cape, Northern Cape. Could we anticipate that it is going to be so many councils, the duplication of the actual council is the reason, and the real concern of the department is the funding to achieve that. Could we anticipate that that could possibly happen? Because if it is, and why is that? We must surely anticipate that that is possible. And is that the intention to create this, I don't mean to say an extreme scenario, to create such a huge regional structure with the concomitant financial burden placed on those structures, on the fund? And how do you manage that process? We say that there should be these four councils, but we're not saying to what extent it should be. The model to be, well, the LSNP model seems to work well. It's by far the largest, considering more than half of the legal professionals in the country, and the minister's perspective. Do we want to have that sort of model? The second model being the coastal region that is also stated in the Western Cape, coastal region as a national council, and in terms of Midland region to deal with fish states and Northern Cape. It's something that I suppose the revision of those says the minister will designate how many regional councils there will be. But it's an issue that could have a highly financial burden if it were to be set up conceivably in the way in which I'm proposing it, then how do you deal with it?
Well, that's what I thought. All right, let's hear your views. Ms. Lutz, Ms. Schaefer, Ms. Schwartz.
Animals end up being funded by the levies of members, and they have to satisfy them. That is certainly a consideration. Now, I'm too interested to hear all this, because as things stand, of course, which the law very strangely provides for the professional needs to be counseled to figure out what the functions and powers of the regional council will be, which is completely unsatisfactory. And I'd just like to ask for clarification. Look, from the point of view of, for example, the constituent guard, I think they have an art council at nearly every street at night, if I remember correctly. I mean, I just thought that you would want a council in every province. But maybe I'm thinking from the point of view of the High Court. And so what Mr. Dyer said is very interesting, as you say. The Law Society of the Northern Provinces is by far the biggest, professional lawyers. And that one, you told us right before, all the disciplines have their store in that, right? That's the office. Are there any offices in the Limpopo and Mpumalanga? There are several. And what happens in there? The day-to-day running of what is?
That's right, offices, state provincial offices, deals with the local province matters, so either seminars, they're in this area, although the Kuchara office facilitates that, they exist, and they would have general meetings for the province on the basis, but by and large, the majority of the functions are done by Kuchara the doctors.
From what you said, it sounds a little bit as though that might be the work of representation and voluntary, and as though the regulatory work and interest of happened in Pretoria. Now, I think that is interesting, but I would have thought, you see, if you go to the DC model, where the report comes from its attorney's chamber and its attorney's chamber, then you would instantly end up having a regional council in each province at these examples once we have appointed job presidents for the project. And considering that your main legal practice council is 4 times a year, has a executive committee of 5 or 6 to deal with whatever their day-to-day work is going to be. I mean, most of the actual practical execution of what is kind of is going to happen at the regional level. And we need to have quite a clear idea in our heads of what that is going to be before we can allow them to fall to follow a function. By four, I mean in the sense what offices there are, how many councils there are. In the meantime, as a guideline, I'm not sure quite useful, there may not, certainly there may not be more than one per province, other than one. At least three or four regional councils sounds not too few. That's what you are, that's what you just catch, isn't it? To draw it up for everybody in the north, a coastal outfit for everybody in the south, or what, as an office in East London, and all the town advocates have to, I don't think so. Yeah, I don't think so. I'm sure that there's a very close relationship between the courts and their bars. And that's the way it should be.
But are they not on these sides?
Are they?
Yes, and the B. Minister in consultation with the
courts. No, that is only after.
Well, not if we ever do this transitional thing at all. And you know, I mean, if the once we've changed to in consultation as we must, you might well say, for what must the minister debate the regulation? The council can decide and go ahead and do it. I mean, at some point you must tell me that B, 332B. At some point you must tell me what things require formal form of legislation as a regulator as opposed to rules, because a proper regulator publishes its rules and that's also the law. So what's the difference? Is the minister empowered with the description not there so that you can sort of actually finally decide, which is why it was after consultation. But I mean, grown-up lawyers are creating their regulated rules and rules that can decide or we must decide. Yeah.
I'm going to stop you with that question. It's Debbie Schaefer.
It's the integrated requirements. And yeah, my understanding, I mean, the regional council is going to be funded by professionals. So. Yeah. That's the first, well done. So, I mean, there's no way that the council is going to go and make a whole lot of them about the show that they don't have the money for, first of all. Second of all, I mean, if you're saying on your example, I'm sorry, I'm part of it, and I'm 60, but there was part of it saying that, you know, you could have one for coastal, whatever. Now, what happens if you happen to have an overland province when you're saying that there should be more than one per province? Maybe the one goes across province kind of in the middle, or, you know, and another one will go along the coastal areas which might span more than one province. So I think we need to be careful to limit this. And if it works better that way, I mean, the Western Cape is huge. You know, the Eastern Cape is huge. So, depending on what countries they're going to have, it's going to also, you know, broadly influence where and how many they're going to want to have in each area. Because you can't have council here in disciplinary matters and people have to travel far on the street.
No, they might.
So I don't think we should be confined in the legislation.
No, I agree.
And I agree, it's going to follow function. Me too. I think we need to say this is always done, the whole structure and exactly and what power is going to go where and so on, and what the advantage to go to these couples. But, you know, I can't see the couples going to establish a huge number of these points over the show, what they're going to find.
One has regard to the transitional council's functions, number 7.2. Which requires them in 24 months to negotiate and reach agreements with attorneys and advocates professionals in the sector of the assets, sponsor assets, rights, liabilities, obligations, and stop to the council or the regional council. Now that is a far-reaching clause, but if that is the case, and if one is mindful that the existing law societies have got buildings, have got assets, surely it makes sense to try to capture that same body, same structure, to make it easier to reach agreement when you're negotiating the terms of assets and liabilities. So say now, for example, Western Cape has got the Law Society of the Cape of Good Hope and they've got a building here and you divide it, but it's too big to put it now divided into a part. How are you going to allocate that asset? How are they going to, they're going to say, well, must we now sell this building and put up another building in Kimberley or something like that? Well, that's the Northern Cape, but somewhere else in the Western Cape. So just, I think to me, if one's going to go this route, it's very of regional councils, one needs to look at the existing structure as far as possible to get the buy-in from the profession to try to make it easier to negotiate the transfer of assets and liabilities. That's just looking at the attorney's profession. Now the advocate's profession, I don't even know how they will continue. They will continue their bar councils and that. So I don't even know what assets they will have because they were all in the name of the bar councils. So those voluntary associations will continue. But here we're dealing with the attorney's professions. Those provincial law societies are regulated by statute. That's the major difference. And they will cease to exist, right? So that must, in terms of this act, so there must be provisions with transfer of the assets to these councils.
Right.
And that's the difference between the two professions. But to me it makes sense to try to keep it, and that's why I'm not so opposed to this, but one needs to formulate something that covers the existing these existing bodies as much as possible, because that, those assets are allocated to where they are. Well, I think it does. It does. I'm just highlighting, we need to look at that, 97.2. And then again, we'll get to that. And then, you know, there's another clause that's very arbitrary, that if they can't reach agreement, they must go to the Arbitration Act. And we'll deal with that later. But there's a problem with that clause as well, whether that is the dead break, the deadlock breaking mechanism at all. But I think that purely from the assets and rights and liabilities, it would make it a lot easier to reach agreement in that transitional council if one tries to stick to what is in existence, and then one can look at 20B1 and see. I don't think we need to have one necessarily in every province now, but that's my first view of that, because if you've got buildings, if one thinks of buildings and assets and liabilities, try to use what is there to make it easier to reach agreement. Thank you, Chair.
We have the northern provinces is the perfect example. You know, initially I said, wow, you know, but now when I think about it, it seems to work. Because I've got the question, why don't they have one in each province? Well, why should they?
Yeah.
It works. You know. Okay, yes. That's the point I'm making, you know, so it must provide for that flexibility.
The geography is not cut.
Yeah.
If you understand what I'm trying to say. The geography of the country is cut up by assets and life.
Don't put it.
That's the word. Now you suddenly can say, well, Brisbane Cape is covered, but we divide it into parts because it's so large. Who's going to get the assets? Where is somebody going to get assets to cover the part that's not covered?
That's
awesome. But,
of the establishment of the first regional councils. So if you have that fight during the transitional stage and it all settles down, why must the council go and rehash everything that's been decided on, that there should be provision for the council after chapter 2 commences to change the areas of the regional councils?
Okay, there are 24 provincials. Cost 200
course, we have digressed some very uncomfortable obligations to hide it. Let's try and do it. Clause 24. I want to stop at 4 a little bit.
Yes.
If I may, I just back to the dissolution thing. I was, can I ask formally that Christine and your colleagues look into dissolution mechanisms of councils in the UK, for example, and the other one with it?
Reduction of the 3 year period, or putting relevant, appropriate experience for you to have to undergone that trial advocacy training period. So that's what subclause 3 is about in a nutshell. Subclause 4 requires an attorney who wishes to get such a certificate to serve a copy of the application on the consul. And a registrar of the division of the prosecutor's accounts and issues a certificate must also submit a copy of that to the council. Subclause 5 deals with the right of appearance of candidate attorneys. That was left, the bill was silent and introduced on this aspect, and it was dealt with in the transitional provisions. The committee felt that we should also put in an option to retain the existing situation, and that is only, as I say, in the footnote, that we can only deal with the situation as far as candidate attorneys are concerned, because that's what the Attorneys Act does. A candidate's attorney may not appear in a high court, Supreme Court appeal, or a constitutional court, and can only appear in a regional court after having undergone at least 1 year of a 2 year practical vocational training. That's what 25 is about. That is considerable, if I may say, narrowing down of what 425 was in the first place.
Excellent comments and request for research. I don't know what's going to
something like that. I just don't think it's a conflict of interest in those debates that we had.
I
don't
know.
Yes. I don't think it was a worthwhile
problem. No, my general sense is that they're not in favor. You know, didn't include that request for something which may just be a matter of academic interest, but that is what I would do.
Yeah, I don't think we
are. All right.
Yeah, is my assumption correct that a pupil does not have right to appeal?
Yes.
Chair, once a person is admitted in terms of the Admission of Advocates Act, he immediately has right of appearance in all courts in the whole country. So, because he's a full-fledged advocate. Pupils are advocates who are on a training program at the Voluntary Association, but they are admitted before. And indeed, apparently, they do some, sometimes as part of the training, they do some appearances and draft documents. No, I'm sure the independent advocates, I mean, they said that they are allowed to appear. Is it on that basis? Because, one thing that could assist with this whole people thing and making sure that advocates aren't put off by having to pay people is now that they're maybe allowing them to appear like county attorneys in some boards before they
complete
their
sentence.
In any court.
All you have to do is
have
your degree and be admitted
to
the court. Then
it's not fair.
Because the article clocks
aren't allowed to do the same. You're getting the same degree. That's not fair.
Should we change it? And don't forget, it's
then we need some kind of guidelines to why shouldn't they be allowed to practice only in some court until they've got their completed quota finish?
Well, they're not in fact the right way ahead. As far as possible, people get so we're incorporating the standards.
Well, yes, we are, but we are also pushing that, which
yes.
is...
Yeah, true. I don't know about the new ones.
And I'm not saying that we're going to
be But you see, I don't think you are saying the ones who are blessed enough after they've paid their $1,000. You can't say
$1,000
and
$1,000.
And
off
your
that can't go off
of
here, but all the others don't get the
blessing. No,
it's
not
the scale of life. It's only possible.
Although we're all not going to be able to go back to our training. Yes.
And some of the training to get to the point of
fear.
And same court, they can't
be on the court. No, it's not. Because an attorney does not appear in the high court, he can, but not for off course. Mm. An advocate is trained to be a litigant in the high court from the beginning point. You choose that career. You know you're going to be appearing in the high court. You can't now be saying that because you're a new advocate, you can't appear in the high court. That to me is the way it's set up. You choose that career with that knowledge.
No, if you're going to have certain qualifications to be registered as a practitioner, then the same should apply to advocates. If they have more intensive trial experience, they can have a lesser period of time to appear in the high court, maybe 6 months or whatever. They can do that. But in a way, you can say, I come with exactly the same degree as you, and on the day after you get admitted, you can appear in the high court and I can't. Sorry.
You realize that you are in favor of fusion.
Yeah.
What we put in clause 25 is really, it was just for an option, isn't the...
I know it.
That's
I don't know
if
because there was... Something she requested here, so we have to ask her.
It's the matter of being
yes, I know, but I would have liked her to hear whether she's satisfied with it. Alright. Shall we stop here?
Yes.
And say thank you to Mr. Bashir.
Thank you so much,
Diana Sloan.
Sorry about these. I mean, our program says we're meeting on Friday. I've now met at least three members who aren't going to be here on Friday. I'm not going to be sitting in the middle.
No.
Yes. Our program says
that's what I advise you early. I'm not here on this one.
Excuse me.
Oh, no.